Assalamu alaikum everyone, and welcome back to Vortex of Truth. My name is Nima Throbi, and I'm delighted to have you join me on this Friday afternoon. Very often, it's easy to make a split-second decision about a topic, especially sensitive topics, without looking deeper and trying to put yourself in the position of the person being judged. It's sometimes unnecessary to do this in cases where right and wrong are outlined clearly, but on the other hand, there are countless situations where a bit of empathy could change a lot. Vortex of Truth is an attempt to evoke that empathy in our listeners. Today's sketch is called Slumber, and we're going to be discussing self-sabotage, specifically the fact that procrastination is a form of self-sabotage and can, at times, be a signifier of a problem that goes beyond typical feelings of anxiousness and stress when faced with a difficult task. Let's define procrastination. Procrastination, according to the Oxford Dictionary, is the action of delaying or postponing something. I'm sure there's been a time or two in your own life where you've procrastinated doing something that seems difficult or unpleasant. Think back to how that made you feel. Procrastination, like any other avoidance tactic, is useful only as a way to delay and hold off symptoms. It doesn't actually solve the problem that you're trying to avoid. So, why do we procrastinate? One of the reasons for this is because the deadline doesn't feel real until it's about to hit you in the face. Human beings often don't see time clearly, and the further something is in the future, the less tangible it seems. This is why the urge to procrastinate can often be beaten by a closely upcoming deadline. You'll be far less likely to procrastinate doing something that has a deadline of an hour than you would something that needs completing by the evening, and that principle applies to other measures of time as well. There's another aspect to this, and that's self-sabotage. Perfectionists, that is, people who hold themselves up to impossible standards and are intolerant of mistakes or less than immaculate work, often procrastinate because they're aware that they set themselves up for failure with the expectations of themselves. It's easier to simply avoid doing the task than to risk doing it less than perfectly, or worse, completely failing to do it. Of course, by not completing the task, the procrastinator is still failing, but they're able to lie to themselves and pretend that they would have done it perfectly had they had the time. Procrastination and a lack of self-confidence often go hand in hand. Shame about failing or making mistakes is very powerful and can lead to a whole host of self-sabotaging actions. Today, we're going to take a quick dive into the mind of a self-sabotaging woman whose fears and actions have taken her into a difficult situation of her own making. Again, today's sketch is called Slumber. Here we go. She's a procrastinator. It's just another unfortunate fact of life, like the fact that her eyes are a muddy brown, the most common color in the world. She's not a jet setter, not an achiever. She was never the one who started movements. Well, she had the intention to. Time and time again, she's indulged in daydreams and fantasies about topping rankings and building empires. But when push came to shove, she'd shy away. Why? It was hard to explain. As a child, her teachers had lamented her wasted potential, and her parents had done their best to attempt to motivate her. None of it had worked. She'd have good intentions, would start off incredibly strong, garnering praise and approval, and then things would fizzle out. She'd get distracted by something a lot more appealing than the textbooks and the worksheets and the revision that she had waiting for her, and after a lying promise to herself that she'd come back to the work after just a little bit of fun, she'd be off. The work would never get done. She lacked strength of will, is what she'd been told before. It hadn't been an insult, just a simply stated fact, and she couldn't even take offense. It was true. She did lack strength of will. She'd do the background work for something, and when it actually became time to start, she'd shy away. Something about taking steps on the path to success just wasn't for her. There'd be some kind of stumbling block, some kind of obstacle in her way that would overwhelm her, and it was just so much easier to give in, to fail on her own terms rather than put herself out there and fall flat on her face. It wasn't such a huge failing. Her life wasn't bad, she was just mediocre. Someone had to be mediocre, and she'd drawn one of life's short straws. She lived a perfectly fine life, was more fortunate than billions of people who dealt with actual pain and sorrow and poverty. She was just an anti-climax. The build-up of her motivation and determination had fizzled out before it could ignite, like a damn squib. Had her siblings been like her, it would be easier to bear. But she'd been born into a family of people who were exact opposite. They did things, made change, went all out and burned brightly. She was the little black sheep of the family, the one in the middle who'd somehow fallen to the wayside. There had never been a person, when she was little, who the family wasn't comfortable mentioning the way she'd seen in sitcoms and TV show. Everyone had done something, and whether or not that something made you wildly rich wasn't the point. The important part was that you put your heart into it. It was what her parents had taught her, always. Live wholeheartedly, find your passion, and nurture it. She had good parents. They weren't the sort of people to try and dictate career paths or life plans. All they wanted was for their children to have fire and conviction, though, of course, they'd prefer it if no one was starving or a criminal. Somehow, she was sure, if she decided to become a criminal mastermind, they would have been less disappointed, because then at least she would have been doing something. She couldn't help it. There was nothing, absolutely nothing, that made her want to work herself to the bone, to pull all-nighters and take risks and cling determinedly onto hope that this thing she was doing would succeed, or she'd die with it. She was just not built like them. She was mellow. And anyway, there was nothing new. No matter where she chose to strike out, she had this pleasure of knowing that someone else had gotten there first. Often a younger sibling, since she'd mucked around so long in her late teens trying to figure out where to go. There was nothing so embarrassing as following in the footsteps of a kid you'd had to babysit after school. Anyway, she didn't want any of it. She didn't want the risk. She had a job that paid her bills and required little enough brain power that she was often mind-numbingly bored from 8 to 4, but at least that meant that she was never exhausted at the end of the day. Her life was, to borrow an expression from her prim and proper sister-in-law, adorably quaint. There was no brilliance anywhere to be found, and she had consciously decided that that was how she wanted it. That was another life lesson passed on from her parents, to make the best of what she had. Hopefully that lesson would stick more than the ones they tried to teach her about success. We're about to take our first break for today, and we hope that you will join us again as soon as we're back from this short commercial break, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum and welcome back to Vortex of Truth. We've just taken our first break for today's show. Today we have been talking about self-sabotage and procrastinating, looking through the eyes of a woman in her early 20s. We're just about to continue that sketch. Here we go. She's looking around her quaint little apartment and seeing it clearly for the first time in months. She's become desensitized to it, she knows, and that's usually an indicator that it's time to move. When she stopped picking up on the little flaws in the place, she's become comfortable. And if she's become comfortable, her loud, shiny family will be wanting to see her little hidey hole. She can't imagine her mother stepping foot in the place and seeing the comfort she does. Those eagle eyes will pick up everything she doesn't want to look at instead. They'll find the cracks in the plaster on the ceiling and the walls where the rain leaks in sometimes, and her mother will be horrified. Those eyes will find the mismatched dishes she's amassed in the years since she's left her childhood home, and her mother will be sad. Worse, those eyes will turn on her, and her mother will find every flaw and inadequacy she tries so hard to bury beneath her skin, adding more. She has coffee in her hand, and the aroma she'd appreciated only a moment ago is now overwhelming. She pours the mug full of liquid into her sink and turns on the tap, waiting the few moments it takes for the water to start flowing before she scrubs the coffee mug clean. She doesn't want to turn from this little nook in the corner and look at the rest of her apartment, at the sofa bed with its worn, comfortable, wrinkled sheets, and the beanbag she uses instead of chairs, She doesn't want to turn around until she can banish her mother's voice from her ears and the older woman's opinions from her mind. She loves her mother desperately, but there's a very good reason that Mum has never been allowed in the apartment she's called home. Her mother belongs in sprawling houses with beautiful gardens and immaculate furniture. She does not belong among second-hand furniture and a fridge with a tendency to leak. It's tempting to stay at the sink and wait, to procrastinate the morning away until she can get a hold of herself and her eyes turn again from critical to accepting. She cannot afford to be critical about her home. It's what she has, and no amount of unhappiness with it will change the reality. This is what she can afford. It's chipped and mismatched and full of scratches, and it fits her. It's fine, really. She's exhausted suddenly. Her sofa bed is all too inviting to ignore, and the thought of her original plans to knock off several items from her to-do list is easy to dismiss in favor of collapsing face first onto the sheets and embracing sleep. Sleep has always been kind to her. Sleep has never betrayed her. Sleep may be her favorite thing in the world. In the back of her mind, she knows that sleeping this often is unhealthy, but the call is too tempting to resist. She feels horrible, groggy and sick, and her head is pounding. She's going to have to get up, and soon, if only to go to the bathroom. But there is no strength in her limbs, and it's all she can do to keep her eyes open. She slept far too much. A yawn forces her mouth open, and she bats at her face, too sluggish to properly remember her manners. She's sitting up when the second yawn comes, and her mouth opens so widely her jaw aches. She definitely slept too much. Once, a few years ago, she tried to research why certain amounts of sleep left her feeling refreshed, and others left her feeling like she'd attempted to fight the bear. A quick Google search had mentioned something about REM cycles, but she'd forgotten the rest of what she'd read. Whatever it was, it had played havoc with her life. Alarm clocks never woke her the way they should, and left to her own devices, she slept horribly, often waking up tired again. Weekdays had the routine of work to keep her sleeping a more or less regular amount. But when the weekend swung by, all of that got tossed out, and she felt more like a drifting leaf, not entirely in control of her own destiny and even her own actions. She'd had plans for today before she got distracted and poured her coffee into the sink and had a mild freakout that had leached all her energy from her. Now, she doesn't want to look at it. The letter. No, not a letter, an invitation. She loves her family. She does. She loves them, and she does it best from afar. When they're close by, when they're in sight, that makes it harder. If only they could all live through screens, able to craft whatever illusion took their fancy, it would be a lot easier for her to live with her family then. That was depressing. The need to put up a front. It wasn't supposed to be that way. It hadn't been that way in the beginning. Before she'd settled for mediocrity. Before, when she'd been determined to be just like everyone else, all clever and intelligent and accomplished and burnt out. It was a perfect way to describe it. Burnt out. Because she'd been flaming out of control. Unhealthy and unhappy, and with a no-hold on her filters. She still remembers it now, the way she'd burst into tears over a bad grade or an imagined slight from a lecturer. They can handle it, her family. They found balance. She can't handle it. She swung wildly out of control in a fast-paced, busy life, and now she's not even swinging at all. She's stagnant, bottomized, lifeless. It's better than what she had been, but not by much. She is a procrastinator. She was even at the height of her busy, buzzing life, she was a procrastinator. It's what led to her downfall, to that giant, disastrous flame-out. She doesn't quite know why, even now, that she's like this. They aren't. Her brothers and sisters and parents. Even her cousins. The hard and fast life works for them because they don't put things off. They jump in head first. She does not jump in head first. She creeps and then turns away. Creeps and then turns away. And then finally she sprints, only because there's something licking at her heels, forcing her to move forward. The invitation. She's trying to ignore it, even in her mind. Her back is turned to it, and she can't even remember what it looks like. She took one look at it this morning and threw it down to make her morning coffee and let the routine settle her nose. It doesn't matter what it looks like. The invitation itself isn't what's important. It's what it signifies. A headfirst jump back into the life she doesn't know how to cope with. An addict would call that invitation a test that she needs to overcome. She knows better. It's not a test. It's an anchor, and it's already attached and going to drag her into the depths. She cannot turn down an invitation to the wedding of her little sister, even if she is going to lose her mind trying to exist in the celebrations. She won't have to do anything. There will be a wedding planner, and her mother is there, and her baby sister. She's never been a biddable child who will go with the flow. B will have all the opinions about her own events. She, middle child sister that she is, will be expected to do nothing more than entertain the guests. And it will be excruciating. They don't understand what's happened to her, so there will be questions. Some of them believe she's addicted to some kind of substance, so there will be questions there as well. Still others believe that she's possessed and she's going to have to bite her tongue while they whisper strange remedies in her family's ears. There is a very good reason to keep herself separate from the world that she was born into. It's sad that that truth isn't a match for the obligation of coming home and showing her face so that people don't talk. Still, she knows what her mother would say. Will say when Mom inevitably calls to make sure that she's coming. B deserves to not have her special days ruined by gossip. She wants to sleep again. There's a lot to do. She must find space in her budget for the traveling, the clothing she'll have to buy, the leave she will need to take. She needs to prepare herself for going back, mentally, so that she doesn't explode and cause a scene. She needs to call her mother. She needs... The house is dirty. She'll deal with that first. Make the bed, see the floors, the bathroom too. She hasn't cleaned it in a few days. She needs to take care of that. She'll handle those errands later. She doesn't even know the date of the wedding. She'll check that later as well. She needs to take a shower too. Hasn't eaten. She doesn't have time to handle those errands now. Her breathing eases as she mechanically makes her bed. And when she's heading to the fridge, she keeps her eyes from straying to the table. She'll deal with it later. Later, later, later. And now it's time for our second break of today's show. We hope that you join us again when we get back after the short break. We are in our last segment for today's show, and we're discussing procrastination and self-sabotage. Our sketch for today is called Slumber. Here we go. It's almost 8 at night. Her Saturday is almost gone, and her back aches. The house is sparkling, and she's done full inventory of her closet. There are some clothes that she can wear, so she won't be going into debt for B, who she loves enough to have seriously considered it while she was cleaning and attempting to do sums in her head. It's too late to call her mother, thankfully. She'll do that tomorrow. Maybe. Possibly. She'll text, at least. Texting is far less tiring than committing to a call. She's opened the invitation. The wedding's in 2 weeks. She knows why they've waited so long to tell her, but it's frustrating even so. She isn't angry with B, really. They're right a little to think that she'll be jealous. B is almost 5 years younger than her. And yet, little B is hitting all those milestones. Her little sister has surpassed her. But she's not a child. She can be happy for her sister. She is happy for her sister. She'd like nothing more than for B to live a charmed, happy life. She wants that for all her siblings. And she wanted to be like them too. Wanting never got anyone anywhere. Work was what got people to progress, and she's just not going to put in the work. She's happy for them that they can. She'd be happier if they didn't treat her like spun glass. But that's tomorrow's problem. For tonight, it's 8 p.m. and she's going to enjoy her Saturday night. Movies, popcorn, and half the contents of her junk drawer are spread out in front of her, waiting invitingly, and she's stretching out happily, ready to lose herself. One of the reasons that she likes movies so much is that they're passive. She doesn't need to move for the story to move. All she needs to do is lie there and experience, and at the end of it, she feels buzzed as though she walked alongside the characters. It's difficult to explain this to others, but Mum and Dad, and so her siblings too, have always just written it off as one of her quirks. Nowadays, they get twitchy about it, because she'd watched movie after movie right in the beginning, when she'd finally thrown in the towel and demanded Mum and Dad come fetch her, that she was done and it was over. They'd been worried, and then they'd been disappointed, and now they were resigned. One problem child out of five wasn't such a bad deal. And it wasn't their fault either. Her siblings proved that. Her problems were her own. She wasn't shy about taking responsibility for them. She's explained it, what happens, more than once. Still, she knows that they don't fully understand. But the message has gone through to them that this is just a part of her. This all-consuming urge to avoid and duck away from stress and competition is just her. They knew she wasn't faking a problem for attention, or out of desperation either. She'd had a meltdown right in the middle of a crowded room while looking at an exam paper. It wasn't something that was easily faked. And then she'd never returned. She'd refused. She still refuses to go back. She's pretty sure that those credits will expire soon, and then the question will be moot, and the thought of that day fills her with anticipation and dread in equal measures. She can't wait for it to arrive, and yet it's going to close a chapter of her life that she won't ever be able to rewrite. That will never not be scary. It's so scary, in fact, that she has successfully avoided talking about it, even thinking about it, for the past 2 years. When she goes home, to her parents' house rather, she's going to have to talk about it. She's going to have to defend spending all day doing mindless data capturing instead of spending her days in a lab or a lecture theatre, making a useful contribution to the world. She lies to herself and says that data capturing is useful and necessary, and someone has to do it. In truth, she's a meaningless cog in a giant machine, and she's miserable. She needs to get out. Maybe Bee's wedding can be her motivator. She could go back to school, get a different job. Her parents would be happy to fund her outright, or give her a loan if she insists on promising to pay them back. She could do it. She could. The fantasy sweeps over her, teasing her with its richness. She sees herself the way she used to be. No, not the way she used to be. Better, a tentative, prompt, in control, no longer avoiding. No longer drowning, no longer out of her depth the way she was the first time. She could. She can't. She knows it in her bones. She'll sabotage it, just the way she sabotaged everything else. Why she bothers to keep dreaming, she doesn't know. Yet she does. It's another way to escape, to run from the world and lose herself in meaninglessness. She can't beat that urge. It's the one thing she's never lost hold of. And that's it for today's sketch. We were in the head of a young woman who seems to have had amazing opportunities at her fingertips and has ruined everything, and now must live with her failure, which stings even more when she remembers that her siblings have succeeded where she failed and finds it very difficult to face up to the reality of her situation and the questions that often come from people who don't understand how things could have changed so quickly for her. Our protagonist has a loving family, as she says more than once, and she has siblings who've done very well for themselves too, both older and younger. It's mentioned that this character is a middle sibling, and possibly some of what's led her astray is a need to try and live up to or beat her siblings by succeeding more than they have. We have a few allusions in the sketch to jealousy, and jealousy is often a powerful motivator, but it's neither stable nor healthy to be fueled by jealousy, and of course, as we know, we're cautioned against it in Islam. Jealousy can eat you up inside and poison your mind and life if left to run unchecked. Our protagonist doesn't really seem overly jealous at this point in time, but jealousy may have been a factor in her determination to succeed, which could have been what caused her to overextend and burn herself out. In addition to that, she has an incredibly low self-esteem that is easily overwhelmed by difficulties and reminders of her past. This fits in with what we discussed earlier, that self-sabotage is often due to a lack of self-confidence and belief in one's own abilities. All in all, she's quite pitiful, terrified of crashing and burning again, and all too ready to simply give up instead of taking a chance. Not lazy, really, as we usually assume to be the reason for procrastinating or stagnating, but rather very, very scared and unable to overcome that fear in order to try again. If you recognize some or all of the coping mechanisms, the very bad coping mechanisms that were described in today's sketch as things that you do, please do attempt to take steps towards improving your mental health. It is a horrible space to live in, and there are better coping strategies out there to deal with the anxiety and the stress that you're feeling, such as self-sabotage or checkout. Shukran for joining us on today's episode, and as always, if you have any comments, concerns, or suggestions, please feel free to get into contact with me, Neera Thrapabi, via email at theimperfectmuslimablog@gmail.com or any social media under The Imperfect Muslima or Neera Thrapabi. Have a wonderful Friday afternoon, and we hope you join us again next week. Assalamu alaikum.